This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. So if you were around a cell phone in the mid-aughts, you probably heard this song coming out of tiny speakers everywhere.
Go, 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 shorty, it's your birthday. We're going to party like it's your birthday. We're going to sip a Bacardi like it's your birthday. And you know we don't give a fuck, cause that's your birthday. You can find me in the club.
There you go. That's 50 Cent in the club. And those of you who had it as a ringtone, you might have bought it from Judd Bowman. He created the company Motricity from his dorm room at the North Carolina School of Science and Math while he was still a teenager. Eventually, Motricity would become one of the biggest players in the ringtone market. In the club was one of the biggest sellers. Judd Bowman started Motricity at the peak of the dot-com bubble and managed to survive its burst shortly after. He has since moved on from Motricity and started another company, Appia. It's one of the largest open app marketplaces in the world and is located right here at the American Tobacco Campus in Durham. Judd Bowman joins us now. Judd, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And it's your birthday. How
yes,
about that?
Yes, it is my birthday
That's
today.
Right. The best ringtone we could have found from from your repertoire. Tell us a little bit about, take us back to the School of Science and Math when you, this is the late 90s, right? And you're messing around with the internet, which apparently you couldn't even have in your room.
That's right. I mean, I was in the graduating class of 1999, and we were living in Hunt Dorm over at the School of Science and Math. And, you know, this definitely dates me, but back then there wasn't Wi-Fi. There was actually payphones at the end of the hall.
How did you get through?
Well, we actually had to drill a hole through the wall in our dorm and run a T1 line into the dorm, which we later, you know, found out was against school rules.
So we had
to wire up some of our roommates' rooms to keep them quiet.
And was this just to surf the internet, or did you have the germ of an idea even then?
No, we started what ultimately became Motricity as a project. So senior year, you know, at nights and on the weekends, we would stay up late at night working on this idea.
And you had, I mean, you have to, again, it's mind-boggling how fast things have changed. End of the 90s, nobody's surfing the internet on their cell phone.
I mean, you know, at that point, people didn't even have cell phones. Part of, you know, being an entrepreneur is sometimes just to be lucky and be born at the right moment. And for Taylor Brockman and I, who started this project, we got our first cell phone senior year. So we got our first cell phones in 1999. And we were rare. I mean, I think most of our classmates, most of our friends, our parents, they didn't have cell phones at this point. And, you know, you talk about things changing. You know, today you're 5 or 6 years old and you get a Christmas present and it's, you know, an Android or an iPhone.
And you were thinking about developing a search engine for mobile phones, which is interesting because really by that time people hadn't even been wired up. Nobody even, a lot of people still didn't have high speed. And you're thinking, oh, wait, those things, that old platform, your desktop, your laptop, forget it. It's happening on the mobile phone.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, the original idea was actually to build a search engine for cell phones. And it just so happens that we got our first cell phone, and it was the first phone in the U.S. that could access the web. And it's nothing like, you know, the experience you have today on an iPhone or an Android. This is a black and white screen. It's a brick of a phone. But we built, you know, arguably the first search engine for these early cell phones. The only problem was there wasn't much to search for. There wasn't that much content.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was whatever you had going for yourself on the internet, but in terms of what that phone could do or particular applications, not much out there.
That's right.
So now what did you do with that? You had this idea. Did you think it could be a business, or were you just fooling around, apparently not enough homework at the School of Science and Math?
Well, you know, we had caught the entrepreneurial bug. I mean, not only were we born at a time when we got our first cell phones in 1999, but you know, that was, you know, the height of the dot-com bubble. It seemed like everybody was starting companies, and we got that entrepreneurial itch. I think I kept telling myself, you know, I should be studying hard to be a doctor. I remember I actually worked for a year as a mentee with an architect. So I was sort of, you know, I was spending a lot of time working in the Glaxo lab at the school. But the reality is I was spending all of my free time working on this project. And it took a while for me to sort of come to grips with the idea that, hey, maybe I'm actually an entrepreneur.
Then what do you do next? Once you realize that, I guess the first thing you do is go out and look for somebody to pay for your idea, bring it to life, right?
That's right. And, you know, I mentioned that at the end of the hall were payphones. And so you know, from those payphones, I made a few phone calls, and we were able to raise a little bit of capital from Taylor's dad, who was a doctor, and my grandmother. And with that, and with graduation right around the corner, we said, hey, this project could be a business. And that's how I got started.
So you get started literally using a payphone to fund the idea that would become ultimately an app store, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Ringtones, it is a little ironic.
Ringtones is the intermediate step here. Now you got 50 grand in your pocket and a pretty good idea. What's next?
Well, so we built this search engine, and you know, as I mentioned, the problem was there wasn't much content out there, and we were actually inspired by what we saw happening in a completely different part of the world. In Japan. So there was a phone company there called NTT Docomo. It's the largest phone company in Japan. It's kind of like the Verizon of Japan. And they had launched this thing that they called iMode. And it was this whole ecosystem of content that people were accessing on these early phones. They, you know, karaoke music, people were downloading games. And I think we looked at that and we said, wow, that is amazing. And that's for sure going to come here to the U.S. And so we morphed the search engine into building a platform that we modeled very loosely around iMode in Japan.
And were you able to access that material? So if it's games and other things, was that the stuff you were getting, or did you have to create your own content along the lines of their model?
It's a really great question. So we couldn't access that content that was in Japan, and you know, it wouldn't have probably made sense here anyway. But the big idea, the unique idea that iMode came up with, was a business model for all these people that would incentivize them to create content. And it was this idea that they would let developers plug into the billing system so that you could essentially charge for content, have it show up on the phone bill, and keep a share of that. And that was the heart of the iMode model. And so we built a platform called Fuel and went around to the carriers and the phone companies here in the U.S. to basically say, hey, this model's happening in Japan. You should build this ecosystem and see what people build.
Now, we got to make the picture here, because this is a couple of 19-year-old kids, right, walking around to phone companies saying, I got this really good idea. How'd that go?
I think that I think we were actually 18, too. So I think the you know, like anything, you can take a weakness and turn it into a strength. And I think that, you know, there were certainly plenty of people that would laugh us out of the room. But there were other people who would say, hey, here are these young you know, guys that have basically built a technology that are very passionate. I want to meet them. And so we would kind of flip that weakness into a strength and get in there and try to close the partnership.
And how did you do initially then? Where did the initial startup money come for your business?
Well, about 6 months after we graduated from high school at the School of Science and Math, we were actually able to raise our first round of venture capital, and it was ultimately about $5 or $6 million. And it closed in March of 2000, which was at the very, very peak of the internet boom, which we didn't know at the time. But I think looking back, we were extraordinarily lucky to be two 18-year-old kids able to raise over $5 million in capital.
You may have gotten the last $5 million in the bubble. But 6 months after you graduate, you should be going to college. You're not. You're raising money. And in fact, you'd been accepted to Stanford.
That's right. I think one of the hardest decisions I had to make was, you know, I've basically spent my entire academic career at this point working towards this day when you get those college acceptances in the mail. And I remember being just absolutely thrilled when I tore open the envelope and saw an acceptance from Stanford. That was a dream school. I'd always wanted to, you know, go to an awesome college. And to have that chance was amazing. But at this point, I'd come to the realization that, hey, maybe I'm an entrepreneur. And, you know, I thought, well, I could go to Stanford and start a company, or maybe I'll just jump at this chance right now. And so Stanford had a really cool program where they let you defer your acceptance. And so that made the decision really easy. I wrote them a letter, said I'm going to take a year off and pursue my entrepreneurial dream. And then a year from now, I'll show up at campus.
Yeah, a block from Silicon Valley. And so not a bad place to be if you decide to go back to school. But I'm wondering what your parents thought of all this.
Well, believe it or not, both of my parents are public school teachers. Mm. And, you know, so they, you know, were absolutely thrilled when I got into college, much less Stanford. And to tell you the truth, when I told them I was going to take a year off from going to college, they were not very happy.
How did you know? I mean, so you've got this idea and you have a vision and you get it and you're young enough to see that things are going to change and perhaps too young to know that you're not old enough to have this idea yet. So you're not old enough to be scared. But what about the business part of it, having to write a business plan? I mean, these, you know, people who have lots of money want to see that you know how to run a business, not just write an application, right? Write a program.
That's exactly right. And I think what was so unique about the model that Docomo pioneered in Japan was that it actually created a business model. It created a business model for developers to innovate and experiment and come up with really cool things that you could do on this new class of phones that could access the very, very early mobile web.
That's great. So you're creating a highway. You don't have to know how to make this stuff. You just have to know how to attract people, aggregate it, and then get it out to a market. I say just. I don't mean to be dismissive, but you don't have to know every element, especially on the technical side.
It's exactly right. I mean, you mentioned earlier the ringtone in the club, and you know, it might be shocking to you, but the reality is we had no clue that ringtones were going to be so popular. We thought it would be games or applications that people would download. We weren't really sure what was going to be the hit. We built and focused on building a software platform that these phone companies could use to create an ecosystem with that idea that plugging into the billing system and sharing that revenue with the content creators, that great things would happen.
Well, we'll find out how you fell into ringtones and how that became the springboard for much more business success when our conversation with Judd Bowman continues. He created Motricity while he was still a teenager. He is now the CEO of Appia right here at American Tobacco in Durham, and we will continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. I'm talking to Judd Bowman today. He created two successful internet startups. Started out here in Durham, Motricity, and most recently Appia, one of the largest open app marketplaces in the world. But before we get there, I want to talk about how this ringtone idea came to you, because as you said before, that wasn't where you were headed, and you had literally, I guess, a wake-up call.
That's exactly right. I mean, we were focused on building this software platform called Fuel and partnering with the phone companies, so Singular and AT&T and Verizon, and trying to convince them that this model that we saw happening in Japan with iMode was going to happen and it was going to be here in the U.S. We never saw the ringtone coming, though. I think if I had to have guessed, I would have predicted it would be games that people would download, that was what was going to take off.
And how was it that you found out about or thought about? You started, I think it's a great story about how you first came to think about ringtones as a possibility.
Well, you know, it happened by chance. We, at the time, were, I think, a 40-person company. And the phone companies in the U.S. were starting to wake up to the opportunity. And I remember that we were competing for a contract to supply our platform to Singular, which is now AT&T, but everyone remembers Singular. And we were flying down to Atlanta, and we were lucky enough to be named a finalist. And then I remember the day we got the call that we had won. And that was an incredible achievement, right? We're a 40-person startup, and this is what we've been working all those years to get to. And so then the day comes, and we're launching this into the wild, and Singular launches the platform. And the demand... actually, now that I think about it, the demand was so strong that it crashed our servers.
Wow.
You know, sometimes I think that if you're starting a startup company and you don't go through one of those moments where your servers just completely get overloaded and crash, you're probably in the wrong business.
Well, and before that, your business crashed, because we talked about you getting in just before the bubble burst, and it did. And that caused some serious trouble for you. In fact, at a certain point, you were just flat out of money, right? Or pretty darn close.
We were extraordinarily lucky to have raised the $5 million right before the bubble burst. And there's no way that we could have seen that coming. You know, sometimes I joke that it was a very expensive MBA because we had to really sort of step back and learn how to survive what became a very tough period of 2001 and 2002. And to your question, I can distinctly remember at least three times when we were down to our last payroll.
Oh. And at one point, you thought, this isn't going to work. You went back to school, or you went to Stanford, eh?
I mean, not everybody knows that story. I basically, we were out of money the morning of September 11th, and we actually had a board meeting to approve what you call a bridge loan. And this is essentially where you're out of money, and you're on your knees pleading with your venture capital investors for one last cash infusion. And they had agreed to do it. And we had a board meeting. And I'll never forget, of course, when the plane hit the towers. And, you know, like everywhere else in the world, we stopped what we were doing. We ended the meeting, and that was it. And And I thought, for sure, this is the end of the company. And, you know, as if things could, you know, be, you know, any more difficult for me as an entrepreneur, I got a letter that same week that Stanford was changing its policy on students that deferred. Maybe it was in recognition that the dot-com bubble had burst, but they essentially sent me a letter that said, if you don't enroll by the end of September, you're going to lose your place and you're going to have to reapply. And so I'm stuck here with a business that I've been, you know, pouring my, you know, sweat and tears into, but we're out of money. September 11th just happened, so it feels like the world's ending. And I have a tough choice about, you know, do I give up my place at Stanford? And I did the only thing I thought I could do, which was I packed my bags and flew out to Stanford.
How did that go? You were back at school. It could not possibly have left you. The dream itself couldn't have been gone in just those couple of weeks.
I think those weeks were probably the toughest weeks I've ever, you know, dealt with. I mean, obviously, you know, on a macro level, the whole world was in sort of shock. Here I am going through orientation, and I felt like I was just going through the motions. On one hand, my startup is essentially on fire and burning and out of money, and I'm sort of, you know, on conference calls in between orientation meetings with my board and investors just saying, you know, let's still give this one more chance. And I also was basically getting a meeting with every administrator I could at Stanford, from the president to the dean, saying, please just make an exception. Give me one more semester off and I promise I'll come after that. And they kept saying no. And so the first day of class comes around, and I remember I was able to get a meeting with the registrar. And she had been at Stanford a long time, and she said, look, if you, you know, register for classes and go for one day, come back and see me, and I'll give you a leave of absence.
A loophole.
I guess.
Well done. Well done. And so you took it. I took it.
Yeah. Not without getting a call from the dean who said, wait a second. But, you know, ultimately, you know, she agreed that it was a loophole and that it worked and that they would hold my place.
So there you are. But it seems to me, was it there that you got, was it your roommate for however long you might have been at Stanford or somewhere where the actual first ringtone, where you heard it because your roommate had a phone that actually came from Japan. It wasn't an American phone.
You're right. I mean, that was one of those crazy moments in your life where, you know, I don't want to say it was that I saw a sign or something like that, but on that first day of class at Stanford, you know, it's 8 a.m., the alarm clock goes off. And, you know, oddly enough, in our dorm room, the alarm was karaoke music. And my roommate was this guy named Matt Bro. And I was like, Matt, what the hell is that? And, you know, he basically tosses me a cell phone. And it was a phone like something I'd never seen before. I mean, compared to the brick of a phone that I have in my pocket at the time, you know, this was a phone that was pink. It was a clamshell phone. It had a full color screen. And he started telling me the story about how he had spent the summer before coming for his freshman year at Stanford in Japan. And he had met a girl while he was there studying. And as he's boarding the flight to come home to the U.S., she reaches into her purse and pulls out this phone and gives it to him and says, you know, I want you to have this to remember me by. And so he had essentially brought back to our dorm at Stanford one of these NTT Docomo iMode phones, which I had only read about. And for me, it really was like a sign. I mean, after the orientation had already felt so weird, I felt like I had abandoned my startup. I took this phone. I took that leave of absence and I flew back to North Carolina.
You started to go around to other companies explaining that this thing is it. Look, they've already got this in Japan. It's coming. I've got it. We've got the business model. Let's go. And you were not receiving a receptive – you were not running into receptive audiences. What were they telling you?
Well, you've got to remember at this point that we're still on fumes, right? We're out of money. We're down to our last payroll. You know, with that phone and not much else other than some PowerPoint slides and some passion – I was able to get my investors to give me that bridge loan, but that only lasted us a couple of months. And so we were still struggling. The other thing is that even though, you know, here was this magical phone from Japan, the phones here in the U.S. were still black and white screens and hadn't really caught up. Japan was so much farther ahead.
And they still had the content. We still hadn't quite caught up with that yet. So they had the stuff and the razor-like phone, right?
Exactly. And so I needed to raise another round of venture capital. And I remember I took a meeting with any investor I could get an intro to. I went door to door on Sand Hill Road, and that's the road that is on the north edge of Stanford's campus where so many venture capital firms are. I flew to New York. I flew to Atlanta. I took meetings wherever I could, and continually investors said no. We were told that we were still too young, even though by this point we were 19, maybe even 20 years old. I would passionately explain, look at what's happening in Japan. And they would say, but it's not ever going to happen here. It's because the Japanese, you know, are crazy about gadgets, or because they ride trains so long into Tokyo that that's why they're downloading all these karaoke tunes. And I, you know, refused to take no for an answer, and I kept going. And I remember distinctly I had 58 straight no's from investors. So we're talking about a lot of rejection.
Yeah.
But fortunately, the 59th meeting was a yes.
I just want to put a fine point on. I want to underscore what you just said, because we're talking about a little more than 10 years ago when people whose job it is to fund this kind of high technology were saying, oh, come on, people aren't going to waste their time on their phones and download, you know, games and all these other. Americans just would never spend their time doing that. That was 11 years ago.
Wow.
That's pretty. I mean, when you think about that and how much has changed, that seems to me like a very short period of time, because I can't remember a time when Americans weren't obsessed with their phones and doing only, you know, spending their time only on their phone. 11 years ago, you couldn't get a dollar for it until you got to number 59. Let me ask you a little bit about that, because, you know, there are a lot of stories about that perseverance. I tried and tried and tried. How much of that is not being lucky enough to find number 59 first, and how much of that is getting your pitch kind of refined 58 times until you finally get to 59 and say, a little less of this, a little more of that, here we go again?
I think it's all of the above. And I think, you know, in addition to that, I think it probably helped to be 19. I didn't know failure. I couldn't accept failure, and I just kept going because I believed that this was going to happen, that this idea of iMode and what was happening in Japan was going to happen here in the U.S.
So you really didn't give up on the idea. It wasn't. Did you give yourself a number? You said, if I don't get four more, it's over. Or how are you looking at things by 58?
Well, I think at the time, I probably would have just kept going. I think now, looking back, you know, I have this thing I call the rule of 60. So if you get told no 60 times, then maybe you should pause and say, maybe this idea isn't good enough. But I think that entrepreneurs have to be almost insanely persistent.
So what happens next? Now you meet number 59 and number 60, who is also open to this idea. Who were they, and what are they like about it? What changed, do you think?
I think the biggest thing is that the world was starting to catch up. The phones were starting to get a little bit more advanced here in the U.S., and we were starting to win some of these early contracts. We were, you know, a finalist with several of these projects. And I think some of the venture capitalists that believed in our vision were willing to roll the dice.
I saw you did a talk at NC State a couple of years ago, and somebody asked you about patents, because the world is changing so fast. And what was interesting to me is that your patents really can't catch up with the technology. You said that the battle of ringtones was already over by the time your first patent was approved. Is that right?
That's a really interesting question. And I think that in general, like, taking a step back, intellectual property is critical. I think that companies have to be built on something really unique, and a patent is a great way to protect it. But the pace of technology change right now is so fast, and I'm certainly not a patent expert, but the patent office is so backed up with patent applications that things just move too quickly. Case in point, one of the main patents that we had, because we filed for patents at Motricity, one of the main patents that we filed got issued to me 2 years after I'd already left the company to start Appia, and the ringtone market had long since peaked.
Pretty amazing. So now what happened to Motricity?
Motricity was a wild ride. I mean, you know, we raised that round of funding, and we won the original deal with Singular. And I'll never forget, but the first day that we fully launched the platform, we sold over $1 million in ringtones.
Wow.
In that one day. And I think, you know, obviously we had gone through so many tough points. We'd been down to our last payroll, as I said, three times, but we didn't give up. And, you know, from that point, you know, as they say, the rest is history. Mm-hmm. Because Motorola launched a phone that you might remember called the Razr.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first very popular phone here that had a color screen, that looked awfully similar to that phone my roommate at Stanford had brought back from Japan. And over the next 4 or 5 years, Motricity sold, believe it or not, over $3 billion worth of ringtones and other things that people downloaded to their phones.
You had to wait for the infrastructure to catch up. But there's also a moment you mentioned earlier that when you first started, and this was, I think, with the Singular contract, right? And there's this kind of geometric effect of people buying. So it's one, it's 20, it's 1,000, it's 1,000,000, it's 10 million. Your servers crashed. They were not happy with this, but they gave you one more chance, right?
That's right. This was December of 2004. And, you know, the truth of it is we never saw the ringtone coming. We had no way of knowing, other than what we'd seen in Japan, we had no way of knowing how big this was going to be. And so here we had worked, you know, so hard to get to this point where we could build the software platform, win a deal with the arguably the largest phone company in the U.S. to create this ecosystem. And the launch day comes, and when we turn the system on, within 4 or 5 hours, we crashed and just completely crashed. The orders came in too fast for us to keep up with. And, you know, after having gone through a point where we were down to our last payroll 3 times, this was like the fourth blow. You know, in so many ways, Motricity is a company that should have probably gone out of business. Yet we kept going, and we pleaded with Singular to give us one more chance. And they gave us 2 weeks to re-architect the system and to add more servers and to sort of brace ourselves for this load. And we turned the switch back on about 2 weeks later. And that was that day where we sold $1 million in ringtones in one day.
I'm just trying to imagine that moment, though. Now, I mean, really, literally turning, you know, you're like Scotty in the engine room hoping the dilithium crystals will hold, right? I mean, what's that like to flip the switch and say, these things have got to hold, right?
We were very nervous and we held our breath. And the good news is it all worked out.
It all worked out. Let's talk a little bit about the infrastructure and some of the things along the way that were in place that made some of this possible. First of all, you went to the school, North Carolina School of Science and Math. It's a publicly funded school. It's a 2-year program for North Carolina residents, their last 2 years of high school. How important is it to have a place like that for young minds to get together, for you to have a roommate who is, you know, sympathetic with what you're doing? To your idea. Did it matter, or was it just incidental to you, do you think?
Going to the North Carolina School of Science and Math was probably the best experience of my life so far. I feel extraordinarily lucky to have had the chance to go there. And, you know, in some sense, it changed my life. I never would have met Taylor Brockman, who started this project with me, if I hadn't gone there, because Taylor was from Shelby, North Carolina, in the western part of the state. You know, I was born in Greenville, North Carolina, grew up mostly here in the Triangle. We never would have met in Hunt Dorm if we hadn't gone to that school.
So there's a publicly funded school that allows entrepreneurs. You had two big businesses. Motricity was here, and now Appia is here, still in North Carolina. And then take us out to Stanford. I mean, here's a university that, and you talked about, you know, the highway, the road that leads from Stanford along the VC road that then funds in Silicon Valley all the great technological developments. That kind of infrastructure, intellectual infrastructure that allows people to experiment, not vocational, right? I mean, you think at Stanford, you don't make what all would. If they were still making flip phones at Stanford, we wouldn't be where we are today, right? So somebody's got to be thinking ahead, do critical thinking, and all that stuff starts building around it. I mean, describe that architecture, because when we hear stories like yours, what we don't often see is what lies underneath it, the infrastructure, particularly publicly funded infrastructure, universities and colleges and universities, high schools, that really contribute to this that wouldn't make it all possible.
I think the irony of this is that had I actually gone to Stanford for any real length of time, I probably would have started a company there. I don't know whether it would have been freshman year or senior year. And the thing is, at that point, there's a real chance I might have stayed out there. I would have met investors and gotten my first funding from likely a firm on Sand Hill Road, that road that's just north of Stanford. And things might have been very, very different. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm lucky that I went to the School of Science and Math. I'm especially lucky that I was able to raise my first funding from, you know, angel investors here in North Carolina. I think that North Carolina is, you know, an amazing place to be an entrepreneur because we have so many, you know, resources, not just the School of Science and Math, but, you know, we have three of the best universities in the world right here in the Triangle that we're able to pull from.
And they do a lot of primary research that allows for the kind of open-minded thinking that leads to this development. So those VC companies, too, they line themselves up because those universities are there, and then the industries, some of them stay and some of them come back home. So they're an important part of that infrastructure, I guess.
It reminds me a lot of probably what Silicon Valley was like 30 or 40 years ago. The Valley exists because of places like Stanford and Berkeley. So you had this concentration, maybe UCSF. And that over time spawned, you know, a generation of engineers that went out to solve problems. And, you know, companies like Intel and Apple sprouted and took root. And it didn't happen overnight, though. It built, and the success of those companies spawned other entrepreneurs, enriched investors that then reinvested that capital into other ideas. And I think that we're seeing that happen here in North Carolina. I think there's a debate about, is it moving fast enough? But I think it's moving at about the right pace, and we just need it to keep going.
Keep going. Hate to see anybody pull the plug. Judd Bowman is my guest, created Motricity while he was still a teenager, now the CEO of Appia here at American Tobacco in Durham. And we will talk more about his career when our program continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Judd Bowman. He created two successful internet startups, Motricity and now Appia. Tell us about Motricity. Eventually, Motricity went public. That was a big day for you, but you sold it. And so tell us why and why you're not there anymore.
Well, I think that the real moment for me is after 9 years of building Motricity. You know, you've got to think, this is from the dorm room at the School of Science and Math, a brief stop at Stanford, to a company that ultimately sold over $3 billion worth of ringtones and had grown to over 500 employees. You know, more importantly, stepping back, it was 9 years of my life. And just like that moment when I was at Stanford and my roommate Matt threw me this phone from Japan, and I had one of those proverbial light bulb moments of inspiration to not give up on the dream that I'd been pursuing, Apple launched this thing called the App Store. And this was the summer of 2008. And I think for me, that's as close to the second light bulb moment I've ever had. I remember saying, wow, you know, this is going to be huge, almost as big as ringtones. And I think we can look back now, you know, Apple's on the verge of 50 billion downloads and counting. It's been far bigger than anybody could have ever imagined. And I was starting to get the entrepreneurial itch to do something new and fresh. And I was lucky enough that after the success of Motricity, the very original investors in the company, you know, called me and said, why don't you do another startup and we'll fund it?
Wow. Blank check?
Almost a blank check.
Wow. Well, that's pretty good. So they have faith in the fact that if you've got a vision, you can bring it through. Part of that must be the perseverance. And then obviously it leads to success. They're happy and you start it up. Did you? And now you've got an idea. So what's the vision? Obviously, Apple has the App Store for its iPhone, and that left a whole universe open to you. Is that how you saw it?
That's right. We basically set out to build the App Store for everybody else. Apple, as only Steve Jobs could do, you know, created something, you know, seemingly revolutionary. And we set out to do for apps what we had done for ringtones. And so we launched Appia and started talking to every phone company and handset maker and carrier all over the world to help them have an app store for their phones.
By this time, it must have been an easier sell, was it?
Well, I think every startup has its challenges, but it's definitely been easier. And I think maybe a better way to think about it is that everything feels like it's moving at a faster pace this time.
And of course, you had Apple behind it. I mean, like you said, when Steve Jobs comes out with something, there is a little bit of a
magic.
There's a little magic, and so off it goes. And do you consider yourself a tech guy? Are you a programmer? Are you a salesman? Are you a visionary? Where do you fit in your success?
I think that's a very philosophical question. I think coming out of the School of Science and Math, I probably most closely thought of myself as a nerd, so maybe a product guy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing is, I've come to the realization that, you know, in large respects, I'm a sales guy. And I've never thought of myself that way. I certainly didn't come out of school thinking that I'm a sales guy. But the realization that's hit me is that when you're an entrepreneur, you have to sell. You have to sell your founder to join you. You have to sell really hard those first couple of employees that aren't even sure where that paycheck's going to come from. You have to sell those investors, angel investors, to believe in this vision that oftentimes isn't much more than a PowerPoint deck. And then perhaps most importantly, you have to sell those first couple of customers to take a bet on a fledgling company that hasn't even really gotten off the ground. And so now I am confident in saying I think of myself as a sales guy.
Well, maybe the difference is if you hadn't thought of yourself as a sales guy, it may be that you would find it difficult to sell other people's product. But when you're selling your vision, it really is in your head and you truly do believe in it. Is that a difference?
Well, you know, the crazy thing is I don't feel like I've ever had a job. I've never interviewed for a job anywhere. I went straight from the dorm room to working on a project that morphed into a company. And then I went straight from Motricity into starting my second project, which is Appia.
So that proves it. Don't get a college education and you won't get a job.
Well,
there you
I'm
go.
Definitely not saying
proof
that.
Positive. Guys without college educations don't get jobs. They just run two very, very successful companies. And so what about that? I mean, is that the advice? Don't get a job and stay away from school?
I think for the longest time, I dreamed about one day going back to college. I think I might be getting – it's my birthday today. I might be getting a little too old to go back to the freshman dorm, though.
Yeah, you're got to be, what, 28 or something like that? You're starting to – I noticed you hobble in here. It took you a while to sit down. 28, 29? Are you in your
30s 32.
Well,
congratulations.
32 today. You got two successful companies. And tell us again, this idea of the app store, you're not writing the programs. You're not – and you don't know what these applications are. You're not making the phones. Somebody else has figured all that out. You're aggregating products. Is it just a marketplace, or do you have to do something to encourage the developers? And is that part of your job, a kind of a highway that allows this thing to become linked and the commerce to happen?
You know, in some respects, it's very analogous to the situation we found ourselves in Motricity, where we built this content platform. We were waiting for that killer app, which happened to be the ringtone. And with Appia, it's very similar to that. We build a platform that lets app developers get discovered. And we don't actually build the apps, but we build a marketplace that that lets them create and innovate and get their app discovered. But, you know, there's over a million apps right now, and it's growing really fast. So if you build it, will they come? App discovery is proving to be a really hard problem for developers.
You also have a pretty good handle on how fast the mobile world is moving. And the numbers are staggering in terms of how many people in the world have mobile phones with respect to the world's population. And you compare that with computers or even internet service. I mean, just give us a couple of facts and figures to put things in perspective for us.
What attracts me to mobile is the sheer scale of it. Believe it or not, there are over 6 billion mobile phones in the world.
And there are about 7 billion people, right?
Right. So that gives you a sense of the scale. And even more profound, we're now in the age of smartphones. And this is probably a shocking stat, but how many phones do you think will ship this year in 2013?
I do.
About 1.5 billion. And to put that in some perspective, if you go back to your first PC, for me it was an Apple II. So let's just start there. And let's add up cumulatively every PC and laptop that has ever been built and shipped. And that number is less than 1.5 billion. So in 1 year in this mobile world, it's like an entire three decades of PCs.
Is the world of entrepreneurs changing as quickly, or is everybody sort of trying to copy each other? And I mean, in other words, are there real technological developments now? Are they moving as quickly as we saw, say, in the last 10 years? Or have things settled down technologically and now we're just building more and more products to use that use that technology?
I think the rate of change is accelerating. I think a big part of it is the fact that everyone is connected now. So you talked about the fact that there's 7 billion people on the planet. I think it is a near certainty that over the next year or two, the entire world is going to have a phone in their pocket. That's where it's headed. And we have talked in the industry for the last decade about the promise of getting a laptop connected to the internet in the hands of everyone on the planet, every child, every person, even in emerging markets. And Android phones have now dropped below $100. An Android phone is more powerful than probably your first four or five PCs or laptops. The amount of apps are staggering. And I think that the world is going to look very different a year or two from now when billions and billions of people in this world have an Android or an iPhone smartphone in their pocket that's connected to the web.
And a lot of your business, most of it, is in developing developing markets, or certainly abroad, not here in the U.S. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, Appia runs app marketplaces for three of the four largest phone companies in the world. So Vodafone, Bharti Airtel, America Mobile. Some of these names may or may not be familiar to you, but they are three of the largest phone companies in places like Latin America and India and Africa. Together, those three companies alone touch about a billion people. Wow. And so every day, people all over the world download apps from Appia, about a million apps a day in 200 countries.
And in those countries, it's not just checking the weather or keeping up with the headlines. In a lot of cases, where there's actual medical technology, medical knowledge that's ending up in the bush, people doing surgery on their cell phone with apps that help get information from a main hospital. It's a huge revolution out there, I guess, in ways that we don't think about here in the U.S.
I think that's right. And I think you have to think about it like a platform, right? So we're not the ones creating the apps, but these are essentially very powerful computers connected to the web that are in the hands of billions of people. So the possibilities for what you can do to revolutionize communication, how people work, it's pretty astounding.
Of course, the big fear is that you can transfer a lot of information this way, and that always sounds good because it feels to you like you're talking about education. And that would be great. But then there's this sense of isolation that we're also a little bit nervous about, people staring at their screens instead of the person next to them and using it as a replacement for social kinds of connection. How do you feel about all that?
Well, or even worse, texting while driving, right? Yeah. I mean, just because of the potential doesn't mean it's all positive. And I think, you know, we've all been at a dinner with friends and you know, find ourselves checking Facebook, and it's like antisocial. You know, I've gotten to the point now where if I'm, you know, at dinner or on vacation, I turn my phone off because otherwise I can't actually relax and be present.
Right. So it's all of that, and we always manage to negotiate these things one way or another. Anytime you sort of, I remember when Mad Magazine and television were going to be the death of us all, and frankly, it's why I'm here. So what's next? What's on the horizon?
Well, you know, if we talk in the very short term, you know, the top app this week is a game called Candy Crush. So if you're looking for the latest and hottest thing to download, Candy Crush, and that's followed by an app called WhatsApp, which is kind of like a replacement for text messaging. But where this is going, the way that I think about it goes back to the scale of the numbers. I think that over the next 18 to 24 months is going to be one of the most radical shifts that we've ever seen in technology. You know, it reminds me of when I was back in high school and you, you know, first hooked up one of those, you know, 24K modems and logged into AOL or CompuServe or something and saw the power, or when you first opened that Netscape browser. And what is happening is Android is ushered in a revolution by bringing the price point of a smartphone down so radically that every single person on the planet can connect. A really powerful example of this is one of our partners is a phone company in Kenya called Safaricom. And Safaricom is the Verizon of Kenya. It's the largest phone company there. Well, you know, you might think of Kenya one way, but interestingly, about 2 months ago, Kenya stopped selling what we call feature phones, the basic phones, and from this point forward is only selling smartphones. So here we are in an emerging market in Africa, and Safaricom only offers Androids and iPhones. So to me, that's a pretty telling sign that the world is changing. It's changing very, very quickly, and we're going to see a world where there are 6, if not 7 billion people all connected with a powerful device in their pockets.
Yeah, and in most cases, in a lot of these in developing countries, I know it's true in Kenya, that they're also the largest employer. Mobile communications is the largest employer, I mean, after the government, I think, in the country, one way or another, that and the ancillary businesses. So it's huge. What are the trends in apps? Are they mostly games? Are they communications? How do they trend?
Well, I think that the most interesting thing for me, so let's look back at the ringtone world. The ringtones that would be popular followed the music charts. And so it was very similar to the songs you listen to on the radio. And, you know, a song would be popular for a month or two, and then the next hit would come along. Well, in some respects, it's similar in the app world. You know, a hit app will come along, and it'll stay at the top of the charts. But the difference is it changes faster. We see the app of the day, but then tomorrow it's something totally different. And I think that, you know, what's crazy about this space is that app developers are dreaming up the next idea right now in their dorm rooms at college. It could very well be the next Facebook.
Do those developers change the technology itself, platform technology, or are they just racing to come up with the next cool idea?
Well, the developer has to, you know, they're stuck with the platform. So they take as much advantage as they can. And at some level, they push the envelope, which, you know, causes the chip companies to have to upgrade and, you know, the software platforms to continue to add new features. But they push the envelope. But if you really want to think outside the box, you know, just look at Google Glass. The platforms are going to be changing too.
Tell us about Google Glass.
Well, Google Glass is this new project inside of Google where you essentially wear a pair of glasses that has a little computer on it and it has a camera, and you are able to sort of tap into applications to do some interesting things. Like, for example, you could wink and that would take a picture. Or the one that I am waiting for, I'm really bad with names. And so I can't wait to have a pair of Google glasses and I'm at a party and I'm able to, you know, look at someone that I know, but for some reason I can't remember their name. And so the facial recognition links up with my LinkedIn profile or my Facebook account and reminds me that, you know, it's John and we went to, you know, high school together and he's currently working here.
Wow. That would be great. Very briefly, what's next for you?
I am heads down right now at Appia. We are growing very, very fast, and it's pretty much all-consuming.
Judd, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Judd Bowman, CEO of Appia, one of the largest open app marketplaces in the world, and you can find more information about him at our website, wunc.org. And that's our program. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.